White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, listeners and students of the International Jew. Welcome to Episode 10, Chapter 8. Today is August 30th, 2012. We're almost into the real back-to-school month of September, when things usually ramp up in a hurry from the August doldrums, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and with me is Hadding Scott.
Hello.
Hello there. Okay, you know, Hadding, this is another great chapter. I really like this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it just has a lot of important key topics that it touches on,
mm-hmm.
I thought. So just really important. And
it gives some interesting quotes.
Yeah, we don't have an intro quote. We don't have one of those little things at the beginning from something. He just starts right in, but it's a fairly long. Well, it's a little over 4,000 words, but we think that we can get through it in this one night tonight. So keep that in mind, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to not discuss unless we think it's really important, mm-hmm. Because we want to get all these words written. And Hadding, you being the designated reader,
yes,
start at any time.
Does a definite Jewish world program exist? In all the explanations of anti-Jewish feeling, which modern Jewish spokesmen make, these three alleged causes are commonly given. These three and no more. Religious prejudice, economic jealousy, social antipathy. Whether the Jew knows it or not, every Gentile knows that on his side of the Jewish question, no religious prejudice exists. Economic jealousy may exist, at least to this extent, that his uniform success has exposed the Jew to much scrutiny. A few Jewish spokesmen seek to turn this scrutiny by denying that the Jew is preeminent in finance. But this is loyalty in extremity. The finances of the world are in control of Jews. Their decisions and their devices are themselves our economic law. But because a people excels us in finance is no sufficient reason for calling them to the bar of public judgment. If they are more intellectually able, more persistently industrious than we are, if they are endowed with faculties which have been denied us as an inferior or slower race, that is no reason for our requiring them to give an account of themselves. Economic jealousy may explain some of the anti-Jewish feeling. It cannot account for the presence of the Jewish question, except as the hidden causes of Jewish financial success may become a minor element in the larger problem. And as for social antipathy, there are many more undesirable Gentiles in the world than there are undesirable Jews, for the simple reason that there are more Gentiles.
Well, exactly. That's the reason, if it's true.
None of the Jewish spokesmen today mention the political cause, or if they come within suggestive distance of it, they limit and localize it. It is not a question of the patriotism of the Jew, though this too is very widely questioned in all the countries. You hear it in England, in France, in Germany, in Poland, in Russia, in Romania. And with a shock, you hear it in the United States. Books have been written, reports published and scattered abroad, statistics skillfully set forth for the purpose of showing that the Jew does his part for the country in which he resides. And yet, The fact remains that in spite of these most zealous and highly sponsored campaigns, the opposite assertion is stronger and lives longer. The Jews who did their duty in the armies of liberty, and did it doubtless from true-hearted love and allegiance, have not been able to overcome the impression made upon officers and men and civilians by those who did not. But that is not what is here meant as the political element in the Jewish question. To understand why the Jews should think less of the nationalities of the world than do those who comprise them is not difficult. The Jews' history is one of wandering among them all. Considering living individuals only, there is no race of people now upon the planet who have lived in so many places, among so many peoples, as have the Jewish masses. They have a clearer world sense than any other people, because the world has been their path.
You know, that's something we kind of take for granted hearing, but it's important. I think that's a real important concept, and that they do have a world sense, much more than any kind of national sense, unless, you know, they're trying to develop this national sense for Israel. But they really want the whole world as their place.
Yeah. Well, it's just that loyalty to a particular nation seems kind of arbitrary to them, because they could just as easily live somewhere else.
There you go.
And they think in world terms more than any nationally cloistered people could. The Jew can be absolved if he does not enter into national loyalties and prejudices with the same intensity as the natives. The Jew has been for centuries a cosmopolitan. While under a flag, he may be correct in the conduct required of him as a citizen or resident. Inevitably, he has a view of flags which can hardly be shared by the man who has known but one flag. The political element inheres in the fact that the Jews form a nation in the midst of the nations.
Well, there it is, that famous idea, phrase.
Yep. Some of their spokesmen, particularly in America, deny that. But the genius of the Jew himself has always put these spokesmen's zeal to shame. And why this fact of nationhood should be so strenuously denied is not always clear. It may be that when Israel is brought to see that her mission in the world is not to be achieved by means of the golden calf, her very cosmopolitanism with regard to the world and her inescapable nationalistic integrity with regard to herself will together prove a great and serviceable factor in bringing about human unity, which the total Jewish tendency at the present time is doing much to prevent. That's a little bit of Masonic doctrine coming out there, I think.
Well, I was going to say, I cannot share their belief or hope that the Jew has a great mission to accomplish for good in the world. But there they are, trying as usual to be very positive as they can be while they explain the truth.
Well, also, this human unity thing is Masonic.
Well, were all those people writing this? Or were they all kind of infected by Masonism?
I'm not sure. I don't know if Cameron was a Mason or not. But I mean, if Ford was a Mason, he may have hired Masons. Certainly,
yeah.
His writers, you know, put his ideas or his doctrines into the books.
But do you think that that's only for Masonry? I mean, talking about
unity, I mean, you get
been,
that,
you know. It may have started around then, though, around that time where they really started pushing that, around the time that Masonry started. But it seems now like it's just something that, you know, is so prevalent.
This unity of all mankind thing is from the ancient world. The cosmopolitanism started with the ancient Greeks, I believe, if not with the Egyptians. People like, who was that guy that lived in the I don't know, the cynics. Some of these people, I mean, the word cosmopolitan is a Greek word. It's
oh, and that really tells a story. You know, we don't want to just be our little tiny spot here. You know, we visit and we know people from all over, and well, that sounds good, but it has its drawbacks.
Yeah. It is not the fact that the Jews remain a nation in the midst of the nations. It is the use made of that inescapable status, which the world has found reprehensible. And I made a note there, compare the Armenians.
Uh-huh.
They're pretty much the same as Jews in terms of being a diaspora and being heavily involved in commerce. But they don't have the same attitude toward the host peoples that the Jews have. They don't regard everybody as their enemy, because they're also Christians, and I think that's a large part of it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The nations have tried to reduce the Jew to unity with themselves. Attempts toward the same end have been made by the Jews themselves, but destiny seems to have marked them out to continuous nationhood. Both the Jews and the world will have to accept that fact, find the good prophecy in it, and seek the channels for its fulfillment. Theodor Herzl, one of the greatest of the Jews, was perhaps the farthest-seeking public exponent of the philosophy of Jewish existence that modern generations have known. And he was never in doubt of the existence of the Jewish nation. Indeed, he proclaimed its existence on every occasion. He said, "We are a people, one people."
Important.
He clearly saw that what he called the Jewish question was political. In his introduction to the Jewish state, that's Der Judenstaat in German, he says, "I believe that I understand anti-Semitism, which is really a highly complex movement. I consider it from a Jewish standpoint, yet without fear or hatred. I believe that I can see what elements there are in it of vulgar sport, of common trade jealousy, of inherited prejudice, of religious intolerance, and also of pretended self-defense. I think the Jewish question is no more a social than a religious one, notwithstanding that it sometimes takes these and other forms. It is a national question, which can only be solved by making it a political world question to be discussed and controlled by the civilized nations of the world in council."
Mm-hmm.
That's Theodor Herzl. Not only did Herzl declare that the Jews formed a nation, but when questioned by Major Evans Gordon before the British Royal Commission on Alien Immigration in August 1902, Dr. Herzl said, "I will give you my definition of a state, and you can add the adjective..."
Of a nation.
"I will give you my definition of a nation, and you can add the adjective Jewish. A nation is, in my mind, an historical group of men of a recognizable cohesion held together by a common enemy. That is, in my view, a nation. Then, if you add to that the word Jewish, you have what I understand to be the Jewish nation."
There you go. That's amazing, right?
Yeah.
A nation is something that is held together by a common enemy. And that's the way they've seen it. And I've never read that quote that by him. Of course, they don't play that up, do they?
No. Well, they need the enemy because they live as scattered among other peoples.
Yes.
If they weren't hostile to those peoples, they'd end up being absorbed by them.
Yeah, but that is not a nation to other people's definitions. But he's saying it, and he's just saying, "This is my definition of a nation, and you can add the adjective Jewish."
Yeah.
Huh. Instead of saying, "Well, this is what we Jews think, how we think as a nation." Well, at least said it.
It really doesn't work without the word Jewish on it. This is the definition of the Jewish nation.
Right.
Held together by a common enemy.
Yeah. Really good.
Also, in relating the action of this Jewish nation to the world, Dr. Herzl wrote, When we think, we become a revolutionary proletariat, the subordinate officers of the Revolutionary Party. When we rise, there rises also our terrible power of the purse. This view, which appears to be the true view in that it is the view which has been longest sustained in Jewish thought, is brought out also by Lord Eustace Percy and republished apparently with approval by the Canadian Jewish Chronicle. It will repay careful reading.
Yeah, and that Canadian Jewish Chronicle must have been pretty... that's what I mentioned last week with Brisbane's... that they picked up Brisbane's article and republished it, and you can find that on the web. But that was the Canadian Jewish Chronicle. They were going strong then. They came out, I guess, probably weekly, I don't know. But they had lots of stuff in there, all very, very, very pro-Jewish.
Okay, this is Mr. Percy. Mm-hmm. Liberalism and nationalism, with a flourish of trumpets, threw open the doors of the ghetto and offered equal citizenship to the Jew. The Jew passed out into the Western world, saw the power and the glory of it, used it and enjoyed it, laid his hand indeed upon the nerve centers of its civilization, guided and directed and exploited it, and then refused the offer. Moreover, and this is a remarkable thing, the Europe of nationalism and liberalism, of scientific government and democratic equality, is more intolerable to him than the old oppressions and persecutions of despotism. In the increasing consolidation of the Western nations, it is no longer possible to reckon on complete toleration.
Well, you're still reading what this quote from this man, but let's remember that this is, he is not a Jew. This is a Englishman.
Yes.
Who is making these Jew friendly? Who's making these comments? But he's pretty right on. You know, he's pretty close to the way they really are and what he was seeing. So.
Yes. Eustace Percy continues, in a world of completely organized territorial sovereignties, he, the Jew, has only two possible cities of refuge. He must either pull down the pillars of the whole national state system, or he must create a territorial sovereignty of his own. In this, perhaps, lies the explanation both of Jewish Bolshevism and of Zionism, for at this moment Eastern Jewry seems to hover uncertainly between the two. In Eastern Europe, Bolshevism and Zionism often seem to grow side by side, just as Jewish influence molded Republican and socialist thought throughout the 19th century, down to the Young Turk Revolution in Constantinople hardly more than a decade ago. Not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is anything but distasteful to him.
Okay. he's a radical because he just doesn't like what other people put together. So he has to tear it down and build his own.
Well, he seems to be saying that Jews will never be satisfied until Jews are in control, more or less.
Well, yeah, that's what I said. That's good. Put it well.
Yeah. All that is true, and Jewish thinkers of the more fearless type always recognize it as true. The Jew is against the Gentile scheme of things. He is, when he gives his tendencies full sway, a Republican as against the monarchy, a socialist as against the Republic, and a Bolshevist as against socialism.
That's really good, I think, you know. And so he's always going to be opposed to what's to the status quo, unless he's the status quo, which he's getting to be.
Nothing is ever enough.
Yeah.
Give them an inch, they take a mile.
Yeah.
Give them a mile, what will they take?
Well, that's why the accusation that they want to take over the world comes from.
Yeah. What are the causes of this disruptive activity? First, his essential lack of democracy. Jewish nature is autocratic. Democracy is all right for the rest of the world, but the Jew, wherever he is found, forms an aristocracy of one sort or another. I took exception to the use of the word aristocracy there. Aristocracy means rule of the best. And what you get with the Jews is oligarchy, rule of the few that have money, basically.
Yeah, okay. You know, that's a good point to bring out. So we shouldn't think about them as real aristocrats.
No.
Of course, aristocracy has lost most of its positive meaning anyway in the more modern world. And actually, I don't know how much it ever deserved, unless you go back to the ancient world.
Yeah.
Then maybe.
Democracy is merely a tool of a word which Jewish agitators use to raise themselves to the ordinary level in places where they are oppressed below it. But having reached the common level, they immediately make efforts for special privileges, as being entitled to them. A process of which the late peace conference will remain the most startling example.
You know, before you go on there, you know, I think that just should be really emphasized that having reached the common level, what they get equal rights. Then they immediately make efforts for special rights and special privileges. I mean, that's so typical. And we see that. And then he mentions the Paris Peace Conference again. They mention that a lot, but so far I haven't found him ever really spelling out what he thinks took place there, except that the Jews got what they wanted.
Well, one thing they got was the British Mandate in Palestine, and that was following upon the Balfour Declaration, which was a promise that the Jews would have Palestine as a Jewish state. So the Zionists thought that they had gotten their Jewish state in Palestine at Versailles, but then the British government saw that there was a lot of trouble with Jews continuing to immigrate to Palestine, and they halted Jewish immigration, and that led to some troubles.
That's probably it. That's what he's referring to, because at the end he uses the word Zionist, and that it's a Zionist program. So that's the main thing that he's saying that they got was that.
Well, there's that, and I think there may have been some perks for international finance in there somewhere too.
I'd like to know just how they did that, what they were exactly, but
yeah. Well, there were Warburgs on both sides of the negotiations, so you would think that bankers got something out of it.
Well, sure, they did. But just how, you know? Okay.
The Jews today are the only people whose special and extraordinary privileges are written into the world's treaty of peace. But more of that at another time.
Well, there you are, see? What are these special privileges that were written into the peace treaty, except maybe things like, we have to not allow the Jews to be oppressed anymore, or we have to give the Jews what other people have, or something like that. I don't know. Or maybe it's referring to Palestine. I don't know. Maybe it's all about Palestine.
I don't know.
Interesting, though. They certainly were focused on this. End of World War I peace treaty.
Yeah.
And how well the Jews did in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No one now pretends to deny, except a few spokesmen who really do not rule the thought of the Jews, but are set forth for the sole benefit of influencing Gentile thought, that the socially and economically disruptive elements abroad in the world today are not only manned, but also moneyed by Jewish interests. For a long time, this fact was held in suspense owing to the vigorous denial of the Jews, and the lack of information on the part of those agencies of publicity to which the public had looked for its information. But now the facts are coming forth. Herzl's words are being proved to be true. Quote, when we think we become a revolutionary proletariat, the subordinate officers of the Revolutionary Party, close quote. And these words were published in England, in English, in 1896, or 24 years ago, before 1920. Mm-hmm. Just now, these tendencies are working in two directions, one for the tearing down of the Gentile states all over the world, the other for the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine.
Well, there you go. Look at it. You know, they say, what are they doing? They're tearing down the Gentile states all over the world. That's what they're about. Now, how can anybody excuse that or think that they're great people or just because they're so successful? You know, they might still become that, which show the rest of the world how to be great people or holy people or righteous people. How can that be? Absolutely.
Well, they're tearing down the Gentile states all over the world in the name of justice and equality.
That's the way the story goes. That's a good point. That's right.
And establishment of the Jewish state in Palestine. Well, that's to protect them from another Holocaust. How can you be against that?
Well, we didn't have that yet at this time.
Well,
but they had things. They were calling other things Holocaust.
They were talking about how the Jews in. I have an article on my blog, the 6 Million Lie of 1906. There was some Jew from Russia. It was reported in the New York Times. It was claiming that 6 million Jews were in danger of being killed by the Tsarist government.
Oh, they had that 6 million were being killed or were starving, and some of that 6 million goes back to before 1900. Yeah, it's just amazing, all those news clippings that have been found.
All right. The latter project of establishing a Jewish state in Palestine has the best wishes of the whole world, but it is far from having the best wishes of the whole or even the larger part of Jewry. The Zionist Party makes a great deal of noise, but it is really an unrepresentative minority. It can scarcely be designated as more than an unusually ambitious colonization scheme. It is doubtless serving, however, as a very useful public screen for the carrying on of secret activities.
Well, there's where that note one is. Oh, I was looking for that because the note one is at the bottom, and I didn't see it going back and looking for it, but there it is. Okay, well, we'll remember that. He talks about. He says the Zionist Party makes a great deal of noise. So it is Zionism that they're saying is the Jewish world program. It's the Zionist program, and however you want to look at that, I guess, or describe it, can be.
Well, you see, you can look at the reestablishment of a Jewish state in Palestine as part of the intention to establish Jewish world hegemony in the light of the book of Isaiah, because it talks in there about how the Jews will rule the world from Jerusalem, Isaiah 60 and thereabouts.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of proposals connecting the reestablishment of the Jewish state with the establishment of the United Nations. And David Ben-Gurion, I believe, even suggested that the United Nations should be located in Jerusalem.
Well, they want the World Court to be, that's something they really want, because they want to mete out the justice. And they want the World Court to be in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Instead, they put it in New York City, which is the biggest Jewish city in the world. But it
well,
isn't.
Well, they've got more power from New York, no doubt, than they can get from Israel.
Okay. It is doubtless serving, however, as a very useful public screen for the carrying on of secret activities. International Jews, the controllers of the world's governmental and financial power, may meet anywhere at any time, in wartime or peacetime, and by giving out that they are only considering the ways and means of opening up Palestine to the Jews, they easily escape the suspicion of being together on any other business. Mm-hmm. The allies and enemies of the Gentile nations at war thus met and were not molested. It was at a Zionist conference, the sixth, held in 1903, that the recent war was exactly predicted, its progress and outcome indicated, and the relation of the Jews to the peace treaty outlined.
Well, and that's what we said last week, too. We were talking about the peace treaty some, but that I recall us saying that that they knew. They planned the war. I mean, they were, you know, part of the planning of the war. They were running the war. They knew probably the outcome. And so they are all prepared for the peace talks to get what they wanted. They knew just what was, you know, how it was going to go. So that's what they're reiterating here again, so to speak.
That is to say, though Jewish nationalism exists, its enshrinement in a state to be set up in Palestine is not the project that is engaging the whole Jewish nation now. The Jews will not move to Palestine just yet. It may be said that they will not move at all merely because of the Zionist movement. Quite another motive will be the cause of the exodus out of the Gentile nations when the time for that exodus fully comes. That's a bit of a nudge wink there.
Yeah, I kind of lost my concentration right there. I'm looking at it again. I've got that underlined. It may be said that they will not move at all merely because of the Zionist movement. Quite another motive will be the cause. They're not. So what's the other motive?
Well, I it seems to imply to me that they're going to be chased out.
Oh.
It has to be something like that, because otherwise I wouldn't understand why he talks around it.
So they suspected already that in 1920 that from just what the little bit that had started happening that the Jews would be chased out of Europe.
Well, that's my theory as to why they worded it that way.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
As Donald A. Cameron, late British Consul General at Alexandria, a man fully in sympathy with Zionism and much quoted in the Jewish press, says, "The Jewish immigrants into Palestine will tire of taking in one another's washing at 3%, of winning one another's money in the family, and their sons will hasten by train and steamer to win 10% in Egypt. The Jew by himself in Palestine will eat his head off. He will kick his stable to pieces." So said Mr. Cameron.
Yeah, and that's so true. I've said that so many times. But, you know, if the Jews had to be all by themselves, and they would just destroy each other, would be funny, would be kind of nice to see what they would do if they couldn't, if they didn't have non-Jews to live around and live off of.
Do their carpentry for them.
Yeah, and I like this. They'll get tired of taking in one another's washing. Winning one another's money. Yeah, the little bit, it's just switch around here and there, and their sons will rush off to the nearest other place to go where they got bigger, more money to make.
Yeah.
So true.
Undoubtedly, the time for the exodus, at least the motive for the exodus, is not yet here. The political aspect of the Jewish question, which is now engaging at least three of the great nations, France, Great Britain, and the United States, has to do with matters of the present organization of the Jewish nation. Must it wait until it reaches Palestine to have a state, or is it an organized state now? Does Jewry know what it is doing? Has it a foreign policy with regard to the Gentiles? Has it a department which is executing that foreign policy? Has this Jewish state, visible or invisible, if it exists, a head? Has it a council of state? And if any of these things is so, who is aware of it? I saw an article by Revelo Oliver that said that there was a letter that Herzl wrote where he said that he had founded the Jewish state at Basel following the first Zionist conference in 1897. So his question, is it an organized state now? Well, according to Herzl, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's why he's called the father of Zionism and the father of whatever, because he says he organized the Jewish state in Basel. Yeah. Okay, and you know, I had an insight here. I don't know, but I'll say what it was, that the Jew is both Eastern and Western, and that's a real advantage that he has. And he brings his Eastern trickery into our Western world and says, you know, I'm one of you. I'm a European. I'm a contributor to Western civilization. And we've gone along with that eventually. I mean, it took a while. Europeans did resist that, but then they finally caved into it. And now he's got this advantage because what they always say, you know, he's not really just a Westerner. He combines these sort of, he's an Easterner, but he's learned the Western ways. And so, you know, it puts him at an advantage. Always, Jews are always looking for their advantage. They always figure out an advantage. They never do anything on an equal playing field.
Well, he gives them the equal playing field, and then they ask for advantages, right? That's what he said.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're gonna look for advantages. They're gonna give themselves right. Advantages, okay. And that's how they operate. Yeah.
The first impulsive answer of the Gentile mind would be no to all these questions. It is a Gentile habit to answer impulsively. We don't think enough, is what he's saying. Never having been trained in secrets or invisible unity, the Gentile immediately concludes that such things cannot be, if for no other reason than that they have not crossed his path and advertised themselves.
That's pretty good.
The questions, however, answered thus, require some explanation of the circumstances which are visible to all men. If there is no deliberate combination of Jews in the world, then the control which they have achieved and the uniformity of the policies which they follow must be the simple result not of deliberate decisions, but of a similar nature in all of them working out the same way. A similar nature in them, working out the same way. That's sort of the socio-biological or evolutionary psychological view.
Yeah, and either way, it comes out the same.
Well, yeah. The difference is that if it's a matter of hereditary nature, then the conspiratorial aspect becomes less important to explain what's going on. You don't have to believe that they have explicit conspiracies if they're just behaving according to nature.
Kind of like what they said about Hilberg said about the Nazis in the Final Solution.
Oh yeah, meeting
they
of
just
minds.
Said, yeah, they had a meeting of
genocide
minds
by telepathy.
There's no plan, yeah, that they ever worked together to do this. So well, they just all thought the same. So they all did, you know, turned out that way. That's very good. Well, we better move on.
Okay, thus we might say that as a love for adventure on the water drove the Britisher forth, so it made him the world's great colonist. Not that he deliberately sat down with himself and in formal manner resolved that he would become a colonizer, but the natural outworking of his genius resulted that way. But would this be a sufficient account of the British Empire? No. Doubtless the Jews have the genius to do, wherever they go, the things in which we see them excel. But does this account for the relations which exist between the Jews of every country, for their world councils, for their amazing foreknowledge of stupendous events, which break out with shattering surprise on the rest of the world, for the smoothness and preparedness with which they appear at a given time in Paris with a world program on which they all agree?
Oh, that's great.
The world has long suspected, at first only a few, then the secret departments of the governments, next the intellectuals among the people, now more and more the common people themselves, that not only are the Jews a nation distinct from all the other nations and mysteriously unable to sink their nationality by any means they or the world may adopt to this end, but that they also constitute a state, that they are nationally conscious, not only but consciously united for a common defense and for a common purpose. Revert to Theodor Herzl's definition of the Jewish nation as held together by a common enemy, and then reflect that this common enemy is the Gentile world.
Putting it together. Putting the pieces together.
Yeah, you notice how the whole world is held responsible for the Holocaust.
Yeah.
You know, Germany may be the focus of it, but ultimately everybody that's not a Jew gets blamed for it.
Unless they were one of those righteous Gentiles who sacrificed their own life to save a Jew.
And gets a pat on the head and a cookie for it.
Yeah, right.
Does this people, which knows itself to be a nation, remain loosely unorganized in the face of that fact? It would hardly be like Jewish astuteness in other fields. When you see how closely the Jews are united by various organizations in the United States, and when you see how, with practiced hand, they bring those organizations to bear, as with tried confidence in their pressure, it is at least not inconceivable that what can be done within a country can be done, or has been done, between all the countries where the Jews live.
So, when you see how closely they're united in these by these organizations, or they really get into these organizations later, and when you see how they can bring these organizations to bear with such confidence in the pressure that they can exert, that's so good. That's what we're experiencing all the time now.
Yep.
It's not inconceivable. What's he say then? That what can be done or has been done. Or that what can be done has been done.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like well, that's a little bit convoluted writing there, but anyway. Makes a good
point. They like to vary the prose a little bit, don't they?
Yeah.
Okay, here we get into the protocols a little bit.
All right.
At any rate, in the American Hebrew of June 25th, 1920, Herman Bernstein writes thus. About a year ago, a representative of the Department of Justice submitted to me a copy of the manuscript of The Jewish Peril by Professor Nealis and asked for my opinion of the work. He said that the manuscript was a translation of a Russian book published in 1905, which was later suppressed. The manuscript was supposed to contain protocols of the wise men of Zion and was supposed to have been read by Dr. Herzl at a secret conference of the Zionist Congress at Basel. He expressed the opinion that the work was probably that of Dr. Theodor Herzl. He said that some American senators who had seen the manuscript were amazed to find that so many years ago a scheme had been elaborated by the Jews, which is now being carried out, and that Bolshevism had been planned years ago by Jews who sought to destroy the world.
Very good. Well, that's putting it at its best, I guess, because they're saying that these American senators and so on were surprised at this, but then somehow it sort of got suppressed. It was being passed around. Everybody was reading it. And then were wondering about it, and then they came up with their story about the forgery. But you say it is a forgery, so let's
go. Yeah, so it's not authentic. Mm-hmm. It's not authentic. this quotation is made merely to put on record the fact that it was a representative of the Department of Justice of the United States government who introduced this document to Mr. Bernstein and expressed a certain opinion upon it, namely that the work was probably that of Dr. Theodore Herzl. Also that some American senators were amazed to note the comparison between what a publication of the year 1905 proposed and what the year 1920 revealed.
I wonder who these American senators were.
You know
any of them? Are they,
I don't know.
Are
if
they
you looked
names?
In a newspaper, you could probably find some.
Yeah.
New York Times archive or something. But, you know, the reason why 1905 would have resonance in 1920 is because 1905 was the Russo-Japanese War. And there was a lot of socialist agitation going on at that time, largely because Kuhn Loeb and Company had invested in the Japanese side of the war. And the socialist agitation led probably to some extent by Jews in Russia, was a sort of a precursor of what happened in 1917.
Okay.
At least that's the way a lot of people see it.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it's not too surprising that something that appeared in 1905 sounds similar to what happened a few years later.
Yeah. Well, that's only 15 years difference. So.
Yeah. No. And not that, but Jewish agitations have been going on for quite some time. One of the czars was assassinated in 1881.
Hmm.
By a Jew, or at least
yeah,
Jews
were involved. Those Jews were—they hated the Russian government.
Well, you know, the thing is, I was reading about that, and actually, this Tsar Alexander II that got assassinated—he was actually trying to make things better. He was making some liberal reforms.
Most of them were.
Yeah.
And the Jews either didn't want things to be made better, or they just hated them anyway. I don't know.
Well, the thing is, the Jews. The person that they hate the worst among the Goyim are the ones that try to be nice to them.
I have something to remember. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
The incident is all the more preoccupying because it occurred by action of the representative of a government who today is very largely in the hands of or under the influence of Jewish interests. It is more than probable that as soon as the activity became known, the investigator was stopped. But it is equally probable that whatever orders may have been given and apparently obeyed, the investigation may not have stopped. The United States government was a little late in the matter, however. At least four other world powers had preceded it by many years, some by many years. A copy of the protocols was deposited in the British Museum and bears on it the stamp of that institution, August 10th, 1906. The notes themselves probably date from 1896, or the year of the utterances previously quoted from Dr. Herzl. The first Zionist conference convened in 1897.
So do you think that what they're saying there is incorrect, or could it be that... Can it fit with what you think that the notes were date from 1896?
I don't know how they get that because Nihlus himself didn't know who wrote it for sure.
Well, maybe they just thought that at the time, so that's what they wrote because that's what.
Yeah, I think this is speculation.
Best idea they had then.
I'm not sure why. Anyway, it's been shown that the protocols are not authentic. Nihlus himself didn't know who had written the protocols. He made the same argument as later people made, which is that the evidence for their authenticity was in the fact that they resembled events.
Yeah, but they could be written. I mean, they could have come from something, but that doesn't mean.
All it proves is that whoever really wrote it was a keen observer.
Well, I guess so. I guess they knew a lot.
And then
it's uncanny.
Then you find the passages in the protocols resemble passages from other things like The Dialogue in Hell by Maurice Joly. And at that point, you realize it can't be authentic.
Well, okay. Well, let's finish this and we can go on. We can chat about that if we have time.
The document was published in England recently under auspices that challenged attention for it, in spite of the unfortunate title under which it appeared. Eyer and Spottiswood are the appointed printers to the British government, and it was they who brought out the pamphlet. It was as if the government printing office at Washington should issue them in this country. While there was the usual outcry by the Jewish press, the London Times, in a review, pronounced all the Jewish counterattacks as unsatisfactory.
Well, what do you think about that? I mean, that you think that, then that would have to be some big, strange conspiracy, trying to work with the Jews, but against, and make it look like you're against the Jews or something, you know, anti-Semitism or something. But, you know, people were taking it very seriously. But anyway, that doesn't, let's go on.
The Times noticed what will probably be the case in this country also, that the Jewish defenders leave the text of the protocols alone, while they lay heavy emphasis on the fact of their anonymity, which is something that Nihilus himself admitted. When they refer to the substance of the document at all, there is one form of words which recurs very often. It is the work of a criminal or a madman.
Well, that's naturally what they would say. Okay.
The protocols, without name attached, appearing for the most part in manuscripts here and there, laboriously copied out from hand to hand, being sponsored by no authority that was willing to stand behind it, assiduously studied in the secret departments of the governments and passed from one to another among higher officials, have lived on and on, increasing in power and prestige by the sheer force of their contents. A marvelous achievement for either a criminal or a madman. The only evidence it has is that which it carries within it. And that internal evidence is, as the London Times points out, the point on which attention is to be focused, and the very point from which Jewish effort has been expended to draw us away.
Well, exactly right. See, they can't deny what's in it, so they don't want people to think about what's in it, but they want to focus on the fact that that it's a forgery. But the fact is that if something leaked out or something got out, then it wouldn't have an author, and it wouldn't, nobody would claim it. It would just be, there it would be. Right?
Well, yeah, but you see, the thing is, anything that's anonymous like that is always dubious. If you look back during the invasion of Iraq and the kind of information that came out from anonymous leaks, it was almost always bad information.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. So I think the Jews actually had a good argument there when they said that the authorship couldn't be demonstrated, that there wasn't even evidence for who wrote it. The interest of the protocols at this time is their bearing on the questions. Have the Jews an organized world system? What is its policy? How is it being worked? These questions all receive full attention in the protocols. Whosoever was the mind that conceived them possessed a knowledge of human nature, of history, and of statecraft, which is dazzling in its brilliant completeness, and terrible in the objects to which it turns its powers. Neither a madman nor an intentional criminal, but more likely a supermind mastered by devotion to a people and a faith, could be the author, if indeed one mind alone conceived them. It is too terribly real for fiction, too well sustained for speculation, too deep in its knowledge of the secret springs of life for forgery.
Now, I think that's a very convincing sentence.
No, not really, because Dr. William Pierce...
But it is almost too real for fiction. It's too well sustained for speculation. I mean, it goes on and on. Who could keep writing all that
realistic
stuff? I don't know who could keep writing all that
there's
stuff.
There's a podcast that originally a radio broadcast that Dr. William Pierce did called The New Protocols, where he points out that the way the protocols talk is not the way Jews talk about their plans.
Well, I know, you said that. You're right. Yeah. You brought that, but that's not real convincing to me. You know what? There's still a lot to go here, it looks like.
Okay.
Or is there?
Jewish attacks upon it thus far make much of the fact that it came out of Russia. That is hardly true. It came by way of Russia. It was incorporated in a Russian book published about 1905 by a professor, Nihlis, who attempted to interpret the protocols by events then going forward in Russia. This publication and interpretation gave it a Russian tinge, which has been useful to Jewish propagandists in this country and in England, because these same propagandists have been very successful in establishing in Anglo-Saxon mentalities a certain atmosphere of thought surrounding the idea of Russia and Russians. One of the biggest humbugs ever foisted on the world has been that foisted by Jewish propagandists, principally on the American public, with regard to the temper and genius of the truly Russian people. So to intimate that the protocols are Russian is partially to discredit them.
Yeah, because they're not really Russian. Okay.
The internal evidence makes it clear that the protocols were not written by a Russian, nor originally in the Russian language, nor under the influence of Russian conditions. But they found their way to Russia and were first published there. They have been found by diplomatic officers in manuscript in all parts of the world. Wherever Jewish power is able to do so, it has suppressed them, sometimes under the supreme penalty. Their persistence is a fact which challenges the mind. Jewish apologists may explain that persistence on the ground that the protocols feed the anti-Semitic temper and therefore are preserved for that service. Certainly, there was no wide or deep anti-Semitic temper in the United States to be fed or that felt the greed for agreeable lies to keep itself alive. The progress of the protocols in the United States can only be explained on the ground that they supply light and give meaning to certain previously observed facts, and that this light and meaning is so startling as to give a certain standing and importance to these otherwise unaccredited documents. Sheer lies do not live long. Their power dies soon. These protocols are more alive than ever. They have penetrated higher places than ever before. They have compelled a more serious attitude to them than ever before. The protocols would not be more worthy of study if they bore, say, the name of Theodor Herzl. Their anonymity does not decrease their power any more than the omission of a painter's signature detracts from the art value of a painting. Indeed, the protocols are better without a known source, for if it were definitely known that in France or Switzerland in the year 1896 or thereabouts a group of international Jews assembled in conference drew up a program of world conquest, it would still have to be shown that such a program was more than a mere vagary.
Keep going. That it was confirmed.
Block my view.
Oh. That it was confirmed at large by efforts to fulfill it.
Yeah. The protocols are a world program. There is no doubt anywhere of that. Whose program is stated within the articles themselves. But as for outer confirmation, which would be the more valuable, a signature or six signatures or 20 signatures or a 25-year unbroken line of effort fulfilling that program.
Now, that's pretty good.
We're not going to finish.
Well, you got only a few more words.
Oh, the point of interest for this and other countries is not that a criminal or a madman conceived such a program, but that when conceived, this program found means of getting itself fulfilled in its most important particulars. Document is comparatively unimportant. The conditions to which it calls attention are of a very high degree of importance. There we go.
Yep.
Rage on, breaking out drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.